Welcome to the Sean Chandler Podcast, a place to talk movies and nerd culture way too much. Joining me, as always, is Griffin Schiller, and we have a special guest today, Austin Burke. Austin, how you doing?
Man, I am doing great. Your all show has been fantastic thus far. Huge fan of Griffin. Sean, we've talked so many times trying to talk about movies and streaming shows and all of these things, and it's cool to finally be here, man. I'm a huge fan.
Yeah, we've been messaging since October trying to do something, yeah. And it hasn't happened yet. Actually, I was out in California, hung out with Griffin, and one of the things I left from that was like, man, I had all these people I wanted to start collaborating with. Your name was at the top of the list. Got home from hanging out with Griffin in real life, messaged you, and then we just haven't been able to make it work for like 5 months. Yeah. And then finally, yeah, we are here about to talk movies way too much. Griffin, what's been up with you this weekend?
Not a whole lot. The past weekend was actually really nice. I got to go have a nice relaxing weekend, go to the beach, time with a girlfriend, not even worry about, the internet or YouTubes and movies and all that stuff. So it was a nice break, but I'm coming back into it full swing now. So heck yes.
Mine was the opposite. It was like super stressful. The good kind of stress, though, I spoke out of town at an event for middle and high schoolers. And so I had to do a bunch of public speaking. And then as we were preparing Sunday morning to go to the final little of these deals I was speaking at, my wife goes into the kitchen to grab a glass. And I'm in the other room 15 feet away. And I just hear a glass go tink, 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 tink. And then glass shatters. And she just starts like screaming obscenities, not typically her behavior to scream obscenities, just like dropping all kinds of words. And of course she does this when the kids aren't around. They think I have the potty mouth. Really, it's her. So she's just screaming. I'm like, what glass did she break? Did she break like my favorite glass and she's upset about it? Did she break her favorite glass? Like, what glass did she break that she's this upset? Then she goes, there's so much blood. There's blood everywhere.
Oh my God.
And I'm squeamish, like I don't do blood at all. And so I'm like, huh, well, that's most unfortunate. Sorry, I can't help. And she's like at the sink, like, what do I do? Like, well, are you okay? She's like, I think I'm gonna pass out. Okay, well, don't stand in the kitchen. Wrap your hand with a towel, walk over to the couch. And it was her hand. It wasn't even her foot. So I was thinking, like, did the glass break and she started tap dancing on the glass? Like, what went down that she cut her foot? But no, it was her hand, which is even weirder. And so I guess the glass dropped and it bounced and didn't break. And so she went to grab it. And then it fell a second time, shattered. And then she, like, stabbed her hand into it. So, she had to get 7 stitches while I was doing my final little talk for this event that I was at. So my weekend was quite exciting. All kinds of liveliness. And so took a few days off for putting out videos. And now I'm excited to talk movies way too much. And we've got a bunch of stuff to talk about. So in the world of movie news, we got a better look at the Batsuit. We learned out about a Borderlands movie, got an update on this Friends reunion. Some insanity went down on Twitter related to a movie called Guns Akimbo. We've got Invisible Man coming out this weekend, so I want to talk about what went down with that monster universe that failed. And we've got Austin Burke. If you don't know, Austin Burke is like the king of Netflix movies and covering them on the YouTube. And so, of course, we got to talk about streaming movies just a little bit with him and pick his brain, find out some good nuggets like that. If you're listening over on any of your favorite podcast places, please rate and review right in these early phases. I'm trying to get that momentum so as many people can discover the podcast as is possible. So anything you can do to kind of leave a score, that's how their algorithms work. And so I rank higher. It's actually pretty cool. I apparently at one point in time, I saw one of the things that I charted at number 12 in the movie review section for at least a little bit of time, which is crazy, like bonkers crazy, looking at some of the people that I passed for a little bit. So that's all because you guys heading over there left some of those reviews. Greatly appreciated. With that said, let's get started talking about this week's movie news. Kicking it off with, we got some leaked footage from someone on the set with their cell phone out filming some footage of the Batsuit. And this little clip of Bat Guy in Batsuit drives down the road. Actually, the motorcycle falls over in the clip. But you really get to see the suit because the footage that Matt Reeves put out, black and red, and so intentionally very stylistic. This one, you're just seeing it in the daylight. Austin, what did you think about this better look that we got of the Batsuit and the cowl and its ears in particular?
Yeah, man, it's interesting because there were so many speculation videos and a lot of people talking. Could it be blue and gray? Could it be this? Could it be that? And we have confirmed that it is more of an armor-based suit. And I love the gadgets within, whether it's kind of the gauntlet or what do the two little circles beneath his hands mean? You know, it's fun to speculate on things like that. But
and all the, like the arrows in the wrists?
Yes. Yes, man, it looks so great. And the cape or no cape debate, it's like, are they going to fill it in with CGI or are they going more the year two Batman route where he's running around with a crossbow and there's no cape, right? So we don't know exactly what's going to add on in post, but man, oh man, I know Griffin's kind of with me in this camp. I am so excited and I love everything we're seeing. It's very different. It's more, I guess, more modern and it's separating itself from the Batman that we've seen on the big screen before, but I am such a fan of these new looks and the fact that he's kind of chasing around Catwoman too. What does that mean for the story? I think this is so exciting.
What about the ears and the cowl in particular?
Yeah, the cowl is, it's interesting because it is, it seems to be the biggest hot topic online. Is the cowl too much? Are the ears? But honestly, I expected the ears to look something like that. It hasn't maybe come together 100% for me just yet. I'm like, because this is so different, but it feels like everything we get, I'm just like, yeah, that's really cool. So I'm a bit biased because I'm so pumped for Robert Pattinson as this character, but so far, I think it looks pretty good.
Griffin, how about you?
Yeah, I really dig all of it. Definitely going along the Batman Zero Year route, which is just like a really cool line, super different. Like it feels like very post-apocalyptic slash like, you know, punk rock. It's got a lot of edge to it, and I think that was my biggest takeaway was like, I feel like this is, it's sort of an indication of where the film is going to go. And if it like the film's taking place in the 80s, correct? Like that is confirmed, right?
I heard 90s, but.
Or 90s. Okay. Yeah. Well, regardless, there is a lot you can kind of delve into in regards to grunge being part of the culture. And I feel like Matt Reeves is definitely tapping into that from like the goons that we've seen from like behind the scenes pictures, from just like the way the set looks to especially this costume. And so like I'm really excited for the fact that this does feel so different. A lot of people are also speculating as to whether or not he's going to have the white eyes because there's the stuff kind of over them. I'm not 100% on that camp in that camp just yet. I think those are more of like tactical goggles for him riding a motorcycle. I think it should be noted that the person riding the motorcycle is a stuntman. And usually when you have a stuntman wearing the costume, it doesn't look exactly like it's going to in the film. So a lot of people are like pointing at like the massive forehead, the really tiny ears, just like a weird sort of look to it. I'm going to hold out on judgment until I see it in action because behind the scenes photos are really deceiving.
Historically, they're not a good way to see things like this.
Well, yeah,
they're designed to be seen from specific angles and in specific ways. Stuntman in the rain, that's not the way they're intended to be seen.
No, exactly. Yeah. So, like, I'm gonna wait until I see an official image of Robert Pattinson in the suit or something like that. But overall, you know, I was holding out hope for like the really, really tall and pointy ears. But you know what? I can take it or leave it. No idea whether or not there's gonna be a cape. If I mean, I assume there probably will, and it'll be CG. But like, yeah, overall, man, I'm really digging everything from this.
Well, what I've learned from the Sonic the Hedgehog, if we are loud enough on the internet, the studio can CGI in bigger ears and do a redesign of them. Yeah, so for me, I've said it before, and this will be always be my preference. I don't like the armored look for a Batman suit. That's not, when I think Batman, I like the simplistic, you know, you can criticize the bulkiness of the Batfleck one, but that's the type I like. Beyond that, just if you remove my preference from it, the actual look of the suit I thought looks really cool. If it didn't say Batman, if I wasn't comparing it to my own expectations, I think it looks really cool. Cowl, I think it depends on the angle. Like certain angles I go, oh, that looks cool. And then he turns his head and is like, oh, maybe not so much that, like,
yeah,
and I, yeah, like at certain angles I see it and I go, that's why people hate this. Like, they're seeing that, that I get you. And then other times I'm like, nah, it actually doesn't look so bad. And so that's, once again, kind of goes back to that. This isn't the footage they released to impress us. This is what that was filmed on the set somewhere with someone on their phone or whatever. And whatever they release is really what I'll start to judge of. This is what they saw when they designed this. This is what they saw when they reveal that to us. That's when I'll have a strong opinion on. I guess the other thought I kind of have on this one is, so this is pretty early on and we're getting some serious leaks. Is that weird or do you think that's intentional or they want people talking? What's your take on that with Griffin?
I think it just happens. Whenever you have a movie of this size, with such a large profile, I feel like it always happens. I mean, like when they were shooting Bond, for example, there were all sorts of behind the scenes leaks of them filming in like Matera, Italy, in like Norway and stuff like that. And like that's actually where we got the first glimpse of like Rami Malek with the mask on. So to me, this is pretty much in line with other films of this size. So whether or not we see more kind of depends on where they're going next for shooting and whatnot. So, but no, I'm not really surprised.
Do you have any thoughts, Austin, on the leaks or anything like that? It feels like there's a little bit more than I would expect this early on. That's kind of why I asked the question.
Yeah, I tend to side with Griffin on these things, but you look at the picture that was just leaked yesterday where the guy was tied up and it had the writing from the Riddler and it looked pretty professional. It also looked like it was the seat that Matt Reeves first tweeted out when he said production has begun. That had to be someone in the crew, right? If this is, we'll say it's legit, right? There's no way someone can just stumble on set and get a picture of like a Chiron or something. You know, that just, it doesn't happen. So some of these things to me feel a bit strategic, and maybe it's just coming off. Maybe it's so random that it feels strategic, but something like that, if that is something we end up seeing in the movie with the guy with the tape around his face and the Riddler's writing, I don't know, man. It feels like Warner Brothers is pushing out, here's the Batsuit. 1 week later, we get a bit of leaked footage from the Batsuit. Here's a little look at the Catwoman. Here's the Riddler coming in here. I don't know. Maybe I'm being a bit too skeptical, maybe that's, but it like, does feel calculated.
So, like, with Endgame, there, of course, were the leaks from the Battle of New York stuff, but that was, like, guy with a telehook, you know, from a mile away. There's, like, shooting through glass and, you know, low res, whereas, like, you know, this footage on the motorcycle, that's a guy like just like right there. And that to me is where I'm going, like, no one is like, hey, dude, we're filming a movie. Why are you filming us filming the movie? And that's where it feels a little bit more so than I normally expect it or it feels a little bit that way. And it could also be that, you know, this happens with every movie, but this one, everyone's actually interested in it. Every single detail about Matt Reeves, the Batman, is really interesting. No matter good, bad, ugly, it's interesting because there's such a history with this one. Because even like the footage of the guy on the motorcycle, because it's a stuntman, I saw so many comments on Twitter. Is that Ben Affleck? Is that Ben Affleck? Well, no, of course it's not Ben Affleck. Of course it's not Ben Affleck. But just that, like that's where people's minds are at. They're just thinking about so many different things and they love the character. So there's just so much more that people are interested in.
I do want to ask you guys, now that we've seen, you know, it's not an official image, but now that we've seen the full getup, what is your favorite bat suit to date? I think, Sean, I'm going to probably agree with you on this one with like the Ben Affleck BVS suit, because I even really liked the stubby little ears and stuff like that. But it was just so cool, that one. Right. But yeah, I don't know. What are you guys' favorites?
The brawler. And it's the Dark Knight Returns. You really feel that. And some people are like, well, he's too bulky. Well, then you see him in the warehouse fight scene and you go, right, he's brawler Batman that's like chucking guys over his head and doing body slams. Like, that is who this guy is. He is thick, he is brutal, and he can still move like anyone. So he's Batman v Superman, Batfleck. That's the Batman that I like live action.
Yeah. Well, funny enough, I'm working on a video right now where I'm comparing all of the live action suits and I'm racking my brain between that specific BVS suit for some reason, the Batman Begins suit, even though it's a bit too, you know, the guy can't move his neck, if you look at him standing there with that cape on, man, that is like full live action, a slight mixture of what Ben Affleck is wearing and what Michael Keaton had. If there was a bit more color in that suit, I would say clear number one. But it's between BVS and Batman Begins for me. I think both of those suits are fantastic.
All right, let's move on to our next one. We'll cover this one real quick. It was announced that Eli Roth is working on a Borderlands movie. I haven't played the Borderlands games. Have either one of you played the Borderlands games?
No, not me.
I mean, I've dabbled a little bit, and I've watched like some friends play, but I'm not like a hardcore fan or anything.
Does his kind of obviously extreme aesthetic match the game?
Yeah, I can understand why people would be excited for it. I think on paper, and ignoring literally everything else he's ever made, it's a good, it's kind of a good pairing. He does have that, like, he has the uber violence in the gruesomeness and like this like archaic like intensity to what's going on in the movie. The games are basically all about like, you know, anarchy and just like it's got a little bit of a Mad Max tinge to it too. But
so Griffin, you're clearly an Eli Roth fan. Which is your favorite of his movies? Was it Death Wish?
Oh yeah, definitely. Honestly, if you're talking between about that or the Green Inferno, I don't know which one's better. To me, the big thing is like, why? I mean, listen, he might be a fan of the games and he might do a good job, but also like, why does someone like that who's just like, I really don't think he's ever made a truly good movie. Like even Hostel, I'm like, why are they courting him to do Borderlands? Like it doesn't like, even just from like a filmmaking and storytelling perspective, like he's not that good of a filmmaker. So I don't know.
His last movie, wasn't it that the Clocks in the Wall movie with Jack Black? It was like a
horror
movie. I don't even understand the trajectory of his career. Cause it was like torture porn, Death Wish, like a video game movie. Like what?
No, exactly. It's just a really, really weird sort of trajectory. And I mean, that one was critically, you know, successful, I think, too. So I don't know. Maybe he's on the upswing. But I don't know. The good thing to take away from this, though, is that it's being written by Craig Mazin, who is coming off of Chernobyl. So maybe it's going to provide him.
I didn't know that. I missed that detail.
Yeah, yeah.
If you guys are listening, looking for another podcast, it's there's one called Script Notes. It's Craig Mazin and John August. They've been professional working screenwriters. And as for things that was helpful for me and even kind of the background knowledge I had going into starting my YouTube channel, everything, listening to like 200 episodes of their podcast was incredibly helpful because they talk about developing stories. They talk about developing characters. They talk about the industry side of things. And it's really interesting to hear two working screenwriters talk through it. And John August has done a lot more acclaimed things. This is a whole rabbit trail that you just happened to mention Craig Mazin. Craig Mazin had been one of these guys that people kind of crapped on for about 10 years because his big claim to fame was doing the Hangover 2 and 3 and then Identity Theft. So he did kind of these lowbrow humor movies that people were like, oh, he's a terrible writer. He doesn't know what he's doing because they don't understand being a hired screenwriter means that you're hired to do a job. And so he did the jobs that he was hired to do. And so then he gets Chernobyl and it's like the best reviewed thing of the year 2019. And so it seems like it came out of nowhere, but some of that's just because people don't understand that, like, no, he's a great writer. He was just happened to be doing lowbrow comedies for 10 years. And that's the job work that he got. So anyway, Script Notes, I haven't listened to it recently, but there was like 2 years straight where I listened to every single one of them. So I've listened to over 100 episodes of their little deal. Anyway, little rabbit trail. Austin, what are your thoughts on Craig Mazin and Borderlands and Eli Roth?
Well, that makes me feel better. I didn't know that either. Because Eli Roth, he has a very stylistic sense about him, and I do feel like it leans into what Borderlands is known for. And once again, I haven't played in the game, but I've seen plenty of imagery and I've seen some people playing through the game before. My buddy was a huge fan, so the looks tell me that, okay, this is kind of a fit, but I'm with you, Griffin. I'm just not a fan of his movies, man. Yeah. Green Inferno didn't do it for me. Death Wish, good Lord. Honestly, my favorite movie that he's done is The House with the Clock on Its Walls. Like, I didn't love that film, but it was cute. And it, but then again, what is he doing? Where's his career going? Now he's doing a video game movie?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's see if the script does something for his actual direction. We'll have to see.
Right. The other thing I will add is that it's also the creator of the games of Gearbox Studios or something like that. The creator of that is heavily involved in the making of the movie. So it's like there's a lot of things that are pointing to this actually being successful. So I don't know, maybe it's actually going to turn out to be great for him, because that gets me really exciting knowing that the people who made the games are involved and that Craig Mazin is writing.
Okay.
So let's move on to our third subject. And this is one that it seems like people are either super excited or baffled by this one. We get our next little update on this Friends reunion special that's coming up, where each of the actors got paid $4 million to do this unscripted, wow, let's sit down and get the whole cast to sit around for an hour and tell stories about whatever they've been up to. And so I keep seeing people on Facebook and on Twitter being like, I'm so excited, a Friends reunion. This is amazing. And I just keep thinking to myself, why? None of these people have left the spotlight. Like, this is just them getting paid an obscene amount of money just to talk, tell their old stories again or whatever. But it's not a reunion movie. It's not an actual, like, here's what Ross and Rachel have been up to. They broke up. They got married. They got divorced. Like, it's not that. So it's just, I don't understand the appeal of this. Do you guys understand the appeal of this?
Well, like, do we know for sure that it won't be kind of like an unscripted episode? Like, is it literally just like them sitting around a table just talking? Or, like, could it be them just sort of like playing in the sandbox that they used to, but kind of like making it up as they go along?
I mean, has anyone ever done that before? Is that a thing?
I have no idea. Yeah. That's what that's why I'm asking.
Like, that would at least be like, oh, okay, there's some continuation. We're getting some sort of additional information that I don't know that any of us will actually want, but at least we'd be getting it. Yeah. But man, I just, whenever I see someone on Facebook be like, why? I mean, what is that? Just the cost of the people. What is that? $24 million? $24 million. How is that? Jeez. How does that work financially? How is there that much demand?
Oh man!
For unscripted. Wow.
I mean, you know, people are going to sign up for HBO Max now, so I think they'll make their money back.
That's true.
I'll be on the opposite side of this. Okay. I am actually excited because I'm a massive Friends fan. I like frequently go back and rewatch the episodes, and I enjoy my time with the characters.
Yeah, that was my next question. So, like, your take?
Yeah. So I'm actually really excited to just hear them, like, even if it is just like a roundtable discussion, I am excited to hear them just kind of like banter back and forth again. Because none of them have really left the spotlight. Like, what is David Schwimmer doing these days? What is Matthew Perry doing these days? You know, what's his name? Matt LeBlanc just had like episodes end, so it's like he's not doing a whole lot. So it's like, Jennifer Aniston is really the only one who's got a lot going for her right now. So I am excited to see this. So I don't know.
Austin, how do you feel about Friends?
This is I love the show. I think the show's great. It's one of those that I grew up watching it with my parents because they were such big fans. We've seen every episode 3 or 4 times, and they would never really watch anything else. That was the only thing. But so it kind of got tiresome. But now I go back, I revisit, and I love it. This is one of those cases where expectation, I think, is going to be so high.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of in Sean's camp on this one, is what are people expecting?
Yeah.
I feel like they're expecting this, we have a beginning, we have an end, and we're going to get there utilizing these characters and their strengths. It's like, no, we're going to take these actors, we're going to pay them a buttload of money, and they're going to go on set, and they're just going to sit and talk. That's what I'm afraid is going to kind of swerve fans to where they'll be, you know, Game of Thrones revolting and, oh, not my Friends. You know, I just, I don't know if this is going to execute, but It is 15 years later.
Yeah, it's just that expectation that, like you said, you grew up with it. And then it's so it's for me, it was my formative years. I mean, I was in middle school when it debuted. And then for other people, it's like your whole life, it's just always been their friends. And then 15 years later, how can it live up to that? That, I'm sorry, I cut you off. You're saying?
Scary. No, it's a scary thought to have trying to live up to, because I feel like Friends fans, maybe even more than any other fans, have expectations for these characters if there ever was a reunion. But now we're getting a reunion, so it's like, are we going to hit on every single point that we've been writing on Reddit for the last 10 years? I'm really nervous for what this is going to do, but at the same time, it's like this nervous, this hesitant excitement, and it makes me more excited for HBO Max, so we'll see what happens, I guess.
Here's a weird question to throw out there a little bit. You talk about the fan base. I don't like go on the internet and look up Friends stuff at all. Is there any toxicity in the Friends fan base? Is it actually really friendly? Because I haven't heard any nastiness related to any of it.
Not yet.
No, yeah. I mean, it's mostly just like people my age who like just love the show. Like a bunch of girls I went to high school are just like hot, like hardcore Friends fans. And whatnot, like they go and they take all like the, you know, BuzzFeed tests and everything, and like they like are constantly posting about it. So it's like, and I think part of that has to do with the fact that like you said, Austin, we grew up watching the show, but like now we're living the show. So it's like, it's become, true, it's gotten that resurgence. Yeah. So, I don't know. I'm curious to see what happens with it, but here's the thing. It ended perfectly, in my opinion.
Yes.
So it's like, to continue on from that almost feels weird. So they're probably taking the right approach here.
And I don't remember when or where it was said, but Jeremy Johns, some point in time I saw him talking about the show, and so one of his reviews, he just brought it up as an example of a show that makes no sense to continue. And he goes, because it's all about a phase of life. It's all about a group of these single people that are where your friends are your family. So it's called Friends, but it's really family. And and doing that later in life when all of them have kids and all the things that go along with it, it just doesn't have the magic. It doesn't have what the show was before, and so it wouldn't work. And I was like, that's one of the more insightful things this Mr. Johns has said. And I have no clue. I have no idea why he would bring that up, but I was like, it just always stuck with me. So as for me and Friends, I haven't told my thoughts on it. You know, of course, it's a classic. It's a funny show. It's a show that I've spent the last over 20 years trying to not enjoy it because of my contrarian side. I can't give you a reason why. I've even tried to, like, you know, I mean, it's the show where they always do this. And then the next episode I watched didn't. It subverted my expectations. Like, it's just one of those ones that just feels a little, it's so popular and has such broad appeal that it just doesn't seem interesting to me to like it. Where even if comparing it to the other NBC show at the time, Friends, excuse me, Seinfeld, just Seinfeld has like a quirkier nature to it that makes it more interesting to me, the way that the episodes were structured. And so I was always more of a Seinfeld person because it had a little bit more bite to it. But, you know, of course, it's a classic show. And I, as much as I want to be just have reasons to, like, it makes me laugh every time I watch it. So anyway, moving on to our next one. This is a tricky one. I don't even know how we're going to figure out how to cover this one. So over the last week, there has been just a reign of insanity revolving around this movie, Guns Akimbo, which no one was really talking about the movie 2 weeks ago, had any thoughts about it. It actually debuted, or I don't know if it debuted, but it played at Fantastic Fest, a film festival that I was at out in the spring and I missed, or back in September. And I didn't happen to see it, but it's like got Daniel Radcliffe and he's got guns attached to his hands. Samara Weaving's in it, chasing him with a rocket launcher. It's just this bonkers action movie. And then the director went full-blown crazy over the on the internet over the last week, and to try and, it's this very complex story. If you want to get the best summary that Griffin and I found of it, it's an article called "No Solutions: A Personal Examination of Online Anger About Guns Akimbo" by Robert Daniels. I'll try and put that in the show notes and down below in the description on YouTube if you want the full kind of background story of all of this. But basically, a whole bunch of critics are pulling their reviews. They're not going to cover it at all. They're not going to post any interviews. Mm. They're not going to, one guy, actually, I don't know if it's, believe this guy or not. One guy is having his quote pulled from the trailer because they're so offended by what the director did over the weekend. So what's the story? What happened? Well, it goes back to a totally different story involving some, Griffin, if you can tell the part about the intro part to it, the prelude.
Yeah, there's the editor-in-chief over at Much Ado About Cinema, basically, she has had a pattern of off-color and racist behavior, and someone posted a DM of hers where she uses the N-word. Obviously, not okay, even if it was back in 2016, and a lot of people were calling her out on it. Some people took it a little too far, or I don't even know if it was that or necessarily like trolls were coming in and just like dogpiling on her. And so she posted a series of videos in which she was basically documenting the fact that she was going to attempt suicide. And so a lot of the writers, I think, before that even happened, before she even said that, a lot of the writers stepped down from their positions at Much Ado About Cinema because they were uncomfortable with her comments, with the culture, and it's not what they believed in. So they stepped down. The website kind of went under, and then that's when the editor-in-chief made those, you know, the series of videos. And then the director, what's his name? Like Jason Lee something. The director of Guns Akimbo basically came out and tagged all the writers who chose to leave and were being very respectful. They weren't, you know, doing anything. They just, you know, were exercising their freedoms of saying, I don't want to contribute to a site that does not uphold
Jason
the moral
Lee
standards.
Jason Lee Howden.
Yeah, so they were like, well, we don't want to write for a site that does not uphold the moral standings that we believe in, basically. So this guy, you know, sees the videos and he inserts himself into a situation that he didn't even know the full extent of. And he tagged all of the writers basically saying that no outlet should ever hire them ever again or allow them to write anywhere. And then those writers started getting harassed. And then like it just continued even after the stuff went down with the editor-in-chief, who I believe was found and is okay at the moment. That part of the story kind of got lost in this whole debacle, which is unfortunate, right? Because it's like the director just kind of like blew something completely out of proportion. So yeah, he starts like lambasting these writers, and then some other writers, I believe Valerie Complex, and I forget the other girl's name, forgive me, but two prominent black female writers said, hey, you can't do this. You don't know the situation. These people have valid reasons for leaving. Like, it was a racist culture there. Maybe calm down a little bit. And then he took it to the extreme and then tagged them, called them out. It was basically saying, never allow these people to write ever again. They participated in the online harassment and attempted murder of this editor-in-chief.
That was a key phrase. He accused them of attempted murder because they called someone out on the internet.
Yeah. Exactly.
And I'll loop back around and kind of try to give what his perspective would be the best I can without defending him. But
So basically then what happens is he makes his account private because the two writers that he targeted were like, you know, posting this stuff around saying, hey, what's going on here? So he makes his account private. He continues, you know, advocating for their like dismissal from the industry on his private account. But then he does something really stupid here. He goes to the Guns Akimbo film account and starts doing the exact same thing, advocating that these two writers were participating in cyberbullying when they weren't even involved in the original scenario. They were just saying like, hey, maybe don't tag these other writers that just don't want to be associated with this website. And so now we've gotten to a point where legal action is actually possible here. And in fact, if he was an American citizen, because he's a New Zealand director, I believe.
Yeah,
he's from New Zealand. An American citizen, legal action most certainly would have been taken. And so a bunch of that stuff happens. He like deletes his Twitter account. He continues his like tirade. He moves over to Instagram even. And then yesterday or the day before, he puts out a statement, which is basically like a half-assed apology. And it's really, really pathetic. And then like Saban Films, who is releasing Guns Akimbo, puts out a statement that's like, we don't condone the director's disturbing comments, but we're still going to release the film. Basically their statement was also not very apologetic in terms of acknowledging what just went down. And so it seems that the dust has sort of settled, but this whole situation just completely blew up, and it's disturbing that an individual like this, you know, it really just shows like the negatives of social media when someone just like completely right. goes off the rails and talks yeah. about things that they don't know about, right? And shows right. a pattern of racist behavior even.
The director's defense in his apology, and that's why it's not really an apology because it was more of a defense of his actions, was basically, my mom was bullied to death, therefore I hate online bullies. Mm-hmm. And so then I was triggered by when I saw this woman being bullied to the point of being suicidal. My mom was bullied to the point of being suicidal. And so as just a self-contained narrative, there's like, you hear that and you go, okay, that makes a lot of sense. But it leaves out so many details. It leaves out the fact that like, that's not really what happened. Your first action as someone mad about cyberbullying was a far more direct act of cyberbullying as a person with a platform, as a person with all of this, like you are the one that poured gasoline on the fire of cyberbullying. You like, and just like no self-awareness, even though he was writing this after everything, like afterwards, after he had very clearly went after these women. He had sicked his army on them as the ultimate cyberbully in all of this. And he was still like, oh, the reason I did this is because I hate cyberbullies. And he didn't have any yeah. self-awareness to say, and I can't believe I turned into one. I mean, so that's where it was just like, you don't even see what you did here.
Yeah.
And then the whole thing has racial undertones because of all the people that called him out, he singled out specifically two women of color. I mean, just a lot of things to it that were just like, what is going on here? And mm-hmm. then the studio's half apology. So an enormous number of people are like, we're not going to review this. We're not going to cover anything this guy touches. And that's, yeah, it's a mess. Like, Austin, have you heard anything about any of this?
Yeah, I've been seeing the controversy just pop up here and there. Here's who I feel for, just avoiding everyone involved with that specific situation. It's those involved with Guns Akimbo who put their blood, sweat, and tears into this movie. And now it's just yeah. riddled with controversy that really doesn't even have anything to do with the film, you know? No. And in the long run, I hate to use the word benefit, but that could be beneficial because maybe there will be some more eyes because it's like, oh, there's a controversy. Say someone comes in and they don't know what the controversy is. They just know there's a controversy, so they're going to watch the movie. But you look at what is surrounding it, it's just a shame, man. And a guy like Daniel Radcliffe, his career, you know, he's trying to get something off the ground. He's trying to get something going right now. And this is just another notch for a movie that really doesn't have anything to do with what's going on behind right. the scenes. So yeah, it's a bad deal all the way around. It's a crazy thing.
Think of like Samara Weaving, who is kind of on this upswing of kind of being this horror yeah. movie darling, and that she gets yeah. What was her Ready or Not in the fall, and so then this is one more thing of her being this person in these crazy, interesting, weird little films, and then she's going to be in Bill and Ted also later this year, and then it's just, you know, controversy surrounding it that just kind of taints yeah. the whole yeah. thing. But
well, yeah. it's also really interesting because it causes you to rethink the messaging of the film, because the film really deals with Daniel Radcliffe, who is like, I guess he's like cyber bullied into like doing this thing, and then he retaliates. And like, given everything that's gone on, it like the way the movie is now framed, I almost feel yeah. like it's like I look at it completely differently because I see the artist who made it and what he stands for and what he's getting mm-hmm. at. And so it's like,
yeah,
it's pretty bad.
Right. Yeah. And it's yeah. very much so when you have that art, such an artistic vision, because even in his defense is like, you know, the whole movie is against cyberbullying.
Yeah.
How are you not seeing what you just did, targeting specific people? How are you missing this?
And I
think.
Well, I was just gonna say, clearly his solution is to fight violent or fight anger with violence, as mm-hmm. obvious of the like as you can see with the movie. Like it's disturbing.
Yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how this one plays out over the when things calm down and if he has some sensibility to give some reasoning that sounds reasonable. But like, man, it just by any estimation, you just step back and look at it like. You've turned into the exact monster that you're claiming that you hate. You are the monster here. And I think even to something you alluded to inside of this of just something that we could all have a takeaway from, we all need to be slower to stepping in and chiming in on everything on the internet. It's becoming way too common for people. Some story breaks on Twitter, and then we all have that immediate emotional reaction and want to chime in and join a side. And there's always benefit in pausing for a little bit to make sure that the facts are right before we go in and just say something insane and just dig a gigantic hole for ourselves. But oh, what a disaster. What a mess. Yeah. Okay, moving along to our next subject, kind of moving on to the more editorial side. So this weekend, The Invisible Man is coming out. And so I thought we'd spend a little bit of time talking about that failed Monsters Universal Dark Universe that they were trying to launch a couple years back with The Mummy. And they'd announced all of these different projects. They put out a cast photo with all these people that they'd hired. They had an office building. And then The Mummy came out, and this thing was dead in the water 2 weeks later. And so why is it that do you think – what was wrong with what they tried to do with – this the previous version of the Monster Universe, and then we'll cycle back around on the back end of this and see Griffin's take on why he thinks Invisible Man's going to be the right direction. But Austin, why did it not work before?
Well, to me, the big issue was it was the picture, right? When they put out that picture of Tom Cruise and Javier Bardem and what Johnny Depp and first of all, that picture was completely photoshopped and it was hilarious. But two, it's like they have this goal in mind, and they almost knew is what it felt like that this was going to be super successful, but they announced it and they went on and announced everything before they knew if The Mummy was going to work. And then The Mummy comes out and it's just a bust of a film. And at that point, pretty much everyone knew, even internally, that, well, this isn't going to work. But, oh, no, we've already announced it. So we, as someone looking from the outside in, we didn't know what was happening. We didn't know if we were going to still get these movies. There were movies that were announced. There were movies that were taken down from the schedule. But they were so overly confident at the beginning. It's kind of funny to think about, but I hate it for the people involved. But at the same time, that Photoshop picture, I just think about it and I laugh. It was just an all-around bad situation for the studio because of the fact that they were so cocky in a way, confident, cocky, that universe was going to work.
I'm almost confused by what was going on there because they put that photo out like 3 weeks before the movie came out. So they had to have like sat down and watched it and been like, this is not billion-dollar material right here. They had to know that, and they still were like, let's put the picture out. Let's still go forward with this. That's what's just baffling to me. Griffin, what do you think?
I mean, look, you're talking to someone who actually will defend The Mummy. I had good fun with it, but its biggest... Okay. I did. I think it's fun when it's not trying to build a universe. That's its big problem. They tried to force... just cram this like Marvel Cinematic Universe into a series of films... or into a movie that really shouldn't have been doing that. And here's the thing when it comes to the Universal Monster movies. In theory, I kind of like the idea of like an interconnected monster universe. I think it could work, but their approach was so wrong because these movies are ultimately low-budget creature features, right? They're really small, self-contained, intimate character films. And that, to me, that's why The Invisible Man succeeded, which I'll get into a little bit later on. But like... what they needed to do was go back to their roots. They needed to do that, and instead they tried to make big budget blockbusters, and I mean, maybe it would work. Maybe you can do that with The Mummy, but you can't do that with films like The Wolfman or like Dracula. No. It just doesn't. It yeah. feels really weird. Like they were just trying to insert themselves into like a world building sort of scenario that doesn't suit their property because it was the popular thing to do at the time. They really just wanted to capitalize on a fad, and I think that's ultimately why it failed. And as you can see with like the DCEU, they kind of learned their lesson from that, and they're like, oh, maybe we shouldn't copy Marvel. Maybe we should just do our own thing. And I think now they're starting to realize that. But what I will say, I think the failure of the Dark Universe is what was the biggest kick in the ass that they needed, because that's what caused them to completely rethink their strategy and like scale everything back and go back to what made those Universal Monster films so special in the first place. Yes.
I wonder how much even part of it is they got kind of sabotaged by their own success with the Brendan Fraser Mummy movies that were just such massive, colossal hits. And they were big budget adventure films, and they weren't small creature features. They were this Indiana Jones meets the Mummy kind of deal. And at that time, that was just the perfect thing that the market needed. And Brendan Fraser was the right guy to lead it. And so it just it kind of turned into this big massive franchise, and I think that created an expectation that wasn't realistic, that would always be the case. Oh, the Mummy, that's just a commodity, that's $1 billion. That probably was just an inflated thing for just that point in time in history. And so then they tried to manufacture a $1 billion franchise out of something that was more lightning in the bottle before. And so you get this movie, and it's like, we'll get Tom Cruise, and we'll get Russell Crowe, and just get all these big name people, and then we'll make it a shared universe. That's working for them. And so it's just all the pieces for a prepackaged blockbuster. And then, like, for me, one of the things that stuck out to me is just like just how quippy it was. It felt like Joss Whedon did a pass on the script or something like that. And it just didn't work for me. Like, I didn't hate it. Like, I thought it was fun. But at the same time, I was like, that was weird. That was like what they're trying to do. So many different things. There's so many different tones, and they're trying to set so many different things up that I don't think that this thing's going to work. And then, of course, obviously it didn't. But I think it's that they had way, the cart was way too in front of the horse. And they, I think, got the totally wrong message from the success of The Mummy, and then looking at where the market was at with the MCU.
Yeah, I mean, like, they even, like, created, like, a universe indent before they even knew if they were going to, like, succeed with a universe. It was like, what? Mm-hmm. It's like, you can't just, like, do that, you know? Like, you have to see if something works, like, if people are interested before you go, like, oh, we're gonna make this a shared universe. And it just reeked of like someone on like a studio like board just saying like, oh yeah, let me see. You see what Disney and Marvel are doing? Look, we have all these monsters. We can do it too. When the fact of the matter is, you can't.
Well, that's the thing too, is it sounds so good in theory, right? If you think about it, these characters all coming together, it kind of sounds like the Avengers, right? But it all comes down to the execution. And how did they go about it? Well, they got too far ahead of themselves, and they tried to play on the tropes that make the Marvel movies good. The humor, the cockiness of the characters, the upbeat nature of the storytelling, which is not what this universe is supposed to be. What it's supposed to be, in my opinion, is what they're doing with it now. And that is what Griffin said. You're kind of scaling it back. They're going back to their roots. And it is way more of a horror franchise than it would have been with the grand scale action. So I think what they're doing now is absolutely brilliant compared to what they were doing before.
And just kind of one more thing on it, like to direct a movie, they got Alex Kurtzman, who long history as a screenwriter, long history of working on big franchises. And it was a little bit like they went, okay, man, you've written all these movies that made a truckload of money, so we're going to let you direct this movie, even though you do not have a proven history as a blockbuster director. Yeah. And I think you even watch the movie and you feel that a little bit inside of it, of the all of his faults as a writer translate then also to him as a director trying to launch this thing that's very complicated. And so then, he's known for trying to, you know, cook with lots of sugar and butter to spice things up with the jokes and the lots of flashy entertainment to cover up some of the faults in it. And that's kind of what The Mummy was like a little bit too. And so, yeah, that, I think you put all that together and it was just very bizarre. I would love to have footage of what happened in the meetings when they were green lighting this, or like, who was the guy that was like, all right, we're moving forward this and let's put the picture out. Like, dude, have you seen the movies? I have. Let's put the picture out. There's like, I don't think this is a good idea.
Yeah.
So weird.
Well, now they're working with Blumhouse, which is also another genius creative decision they could have made. So like they're just,
oh yes,
they're learning all the right lessons from that failure, thankfully.
So using that as the transition, so I haven't seen Invisible Man. Austin hasn't seen Invisible Man. Yep. Griffin, you have, but let's kind of talk about why we think this is probably a little bit of a better fit. I think you alluded to it before, that the inherent nature of these characters is that they're not big blockbusters. They're not designed to make $1 billion. They're interesting, yep, kind of smaller stories. And so that lines up very well with the Blumhouse model of a high concept film that you can tell this contained story with it. And in the case of this one, you bring in kind of this director that has a very distinct way that he does things. And he doesn't need $50 million. He doesn't need $200 million. With, yes, under $10 million, he can tell a compelling, confined story. And he's been doing that for a long time. And you do that with these characters and you start kind of printing money, I'm guessing.
Yeah,
Griffin, you've seen the movie. You can actually say something as an educated person, unlike me, who's just guessing.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, first of all, I'm completely floored by the film. I think it's, I think a lot of people are going to have fun with this. It's really just edge of your seat, like classic Hitchcockian psychological thriller. Nice. I think Lee Winnell said something really interesting in an interview. He talked about the fact that these monsters have become such a staple of pop culture to the point where they're not even scary anymore. Like he used the example of like Adam Sandler voicing a cartoon version of Dracula.
Yeah.
It's like we've gotten to that point when, like, in hindsight, or not in hindsight, but like in actuality, these characters used to be really terrifying, and they used to, and the films used to focus on like cutting edge craftsmanship. We don't see that anymore from these properties. And so, like, his goal with this film was to die, like just cut out all the noise and all the excess and get back to the root of what made these characters special. And so I think he was able to do that successfully, and he was able to actually make the Invisible Man terrifying again for a 2020 audience, for the 21st century even. It's just, I think the entire approach in the model that they're going with here, just letting filmmakers come in and pitch ideas, similar to kind of what they're doing with the DC films, is genius. They've really reworked their model to the point where it is filmmaker centric as opposed to studio centric. They're like, I think he like even talked about a meeting he had with Jason Blum, and he was like, yeah, I was talking to them about something else, and then they brought up the fact, they were like, so, Invisible Man, would you be interested in that? And he's like, oh, I don't have any, like, thoughts about the Invisible Man. And then he, like, stepped away, came up with this really timely and poignant story, and it's effective. It works beautifully. I think they need to do that with all of their monsters kind of going forward. Not necessarily doing the same thing as the Invisible Man, but, like, taking a similar approach.
Austin, what do you think about Blumhouse starting to work with these monster universals creatures features?
It's perfect. If you're going to do this with a set of characters or creatures, or I think this is the perfect, the monster universe is the perfect thing to do it for. And I love Blumhouse's model, man. Even you look at a movie like Fantasy Island, and you know, it's a bad movie in my opinion, but they're doing this on a small budget and they're making money. Well, now they're transferring that over to these characters using smaller budgets, making it more filmmaker centric. but they're going to make a lot more money because these are recognizable characters and they're getting recognizable actors and actresses. And I love what I'm seeing from The Invisible Man so far. And even the first trailer, I was like, okay, maybe they showed too much of the movie. That was my biggest critique. But now I'm hearing that they didn't show anything. Now I'm hearing that the twists and turns along the way weren't even showed to us in that first trailer. So I love the model. I just love the way that they structure their company. Not every movie works, obviously. There are some Blumhouse films that fall completely flat. But in terms of this universe and these specific characters, I think this is a brilliant way to do it. And I think The Invisible Man could start it out. From what Griffin's saying, man, you're getting me so excited. I think this is the perfect way to start out this universe.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, it's... I mean, I tweeted this out, but I really do think that, you know, looking back, like, several years down the road, this is going to be, like, a modern horror classic.
Oh, my heart. Oh, that's great.
Now that's I feel awesome. Even worse that I didn't RSVP to see the press screen.
That's my awesome. Job, Sean. I have to shame you.
All right. Speak, kind of using something Austin said in their transition, you mentioned the Blumhouse model. From there, we'll move over to the, Austin, your area of expertise, Netflix original films, and we're kind of having... Like when I was growing up, they used to have all of these made-for-TV movies that were always like TV-level quality, generally not very good. But now we have this new thing, Netflix original movies, Disney Plus original movies, HBO Max original, all these streaming services are creating their own original films. And it's kind of changing the market around, moving the pieces around a little bit. And so I wanted to talk about some of the advantages and disadvantages of what we're seeing with this. Because especially, you know, last fall, you have Martin Scorsese, he puts out one of his movies on Netflix and has some very polarizing statements to say about what's going on with theaters and Marvel movies. So, Austin, you're someone that covers an excessive number of these Netflix original films. What's your take on Netflix original films as a business model and as a place inside of the film industry?
Well, watching them, I'll say progress and at the same time digress in some ways, but progress over the last 2 years specifically. I mean, when the films first started coming out, obviously you had the big ones at the beginning, but for a long period of time, it was just these smaller, and I've said this so many times in my Netflix reviews, like, this is like a Hallmark original. They focused on the teen rom-coms, and we still get those. We got the Noah Centineo. It feels like he's got 17,000 movies on Netflix right now, and they're still placed here and there. But then we get directors like a Noah Baumbach, and we get directors like a Martin Scorsese, and we get these big-time filmmakers that say, hey, this is going to appeal to a bigger audience. And I think Scorsese learned his I don't want to say lesson, but with the movie like Silence, I feel like that film was primed for a Netflix release originally because no one watched that movie. And I thought it was a really well-made movie. So he took the route with The Irishman. I'm going to put this out on a streaming service. I'm going to see how many people see it. And from what we've seen, the way that Netflix does their stuff is interesting. But from what we've seen, a lot of people have watched that movie. Maybe it was in chunks. Maybe it was in increments. And maybe it's not the way that Steven Spielberg would want to watch a film, even though he's working with Apple Plus. But there are a lot of back and forths on, is it the way to consume? Is it the way to take in a film? But even then, I feel like the quality of these bigger Netflix films, not necessarily this year. There was one recently, oh my goodness. But overall, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But overall, I think the quality has continued to enhance with these bigger, like your Irishmans, like your Marriage Stories, like your Dolomites. I mean, my goodness, we had an Eddie Murphy resurgence on a streaming platform where millions of people didn't even have to leave their homes to watch this guy come back into the spotlight. And I think that was the perfect way to do it. So it has changed very much over the last few years, even though with every good movie, we still get about 5 or 6 bad ones. And I want that to improve. But overall, we've been getting more and more bigger, better films.
Griffin, what's your take on kind of these Netflix movies and the model in general?
I think they're just making so much. Well, first of all, they're so far in debt, it's still like amazing that they're still afloat as a company. I really do think that like one of these days they're gonna go under, but like, you know, Austin kind of talked about the fact that it's like for every truly great movie, we get about mm-hmm. like a dozen or so, like, not so great ones. But like the thing is, they can kind of afford to just dump stuff on there because like people are looking for different things. Smaller movies have a better chance of finding a wider audience and becoming like the next big thing. Like, I really don't think a movie like Bird Box would have gotten the reception it had it not been released yes. on a streaming service. Like, first of all,
right, exactly.
not a great movie. Yeah, like, not a great movie at all, but it had Sandra Bullock attached to it. Mm-hmm. And people like were like, oh, it's on Netflix, let's go check it out. And then, like, you know, it turns into like a giant meme and everything. And so, like, it's become part of like internet culture. And so, like, because it's so steeped in that, a filmmaker like Martin Scorsese can release a film on there and then people are going to be more likely to check it out. Like, as much as I love the theatrical experience, more people these days are staying at home watching stuff on Netflix because they don't want to go out. They don't want to spend the money and stuff like that. And so, it is an interesting sort of time we're living in. Unfortunately, I do think that it's just kind of circling back and becoming cable with literally every, you know, media conglomerate on the planet making a streaming service. Like, we've got HBO Max, we've got NBC's Peacock, we've got, God, Hulu, Amazon Prime. It's just like people are going to start selling bundles and then it's just, it's going to be cable again. So it's like that part of it I don't like. In principle, I love everything that Netflix is doing, and I, you know, with their success recently and really like getting into the Oscars and like getting films nominated, I really think they're starting to break through there, especially. And you'll see a Netflix film. I think you're going to see a Netflix film win Best Picture in the near future just because of the projects they're choosing to tackle. But just to kind of wrap this whole thing up, I love that they're investing in filmmakers and they're allowing them to make the films that they want to make. It's got its ups and downs, but I think it's mostly positive.
Yeah, what I love about it is that they are making it so a bunch of the movies that aren't making it into the theaters these days have a place now. So in the theater, a lot of the mid-budget rom-coms, action movies, they're just not the stuff that's doing well outside of Blumhouse. They're like the one company that's able to do kind of that middle-of-the-road stuff. And everything else is just like low budget indie, big blockbuster franchises. And now there is that middle spot to where not only do these movies get made, but people watch them. And it's a place where stars still get people to click. Bird Box being the perfect example of it, of, oh, a Sandra Bullock movie where this concept and people, oh, interesting. And people still click when it's Netflix. They're not going to go and load up the family and pay $30 to watch it, but they'll have the family sit down and watch it in their living room. And so I think that's a really good thing that more movies are being made in that weren't getting made as much. And, you know, certainly there's validity to kind of Martin Scorsese's criticism that, you know, comic book movies are these roller coaster rides that are just dominating the theaters, but it's not.
Yeah.
It's not because Marvel's the villains. That's just the behavior of audiences these days. And I think a little bit of that even comes back down to TV technology is at a point right now that it's, you have a huge TV that's bright, vibrant, and you have surround sound in your home. And sometimes it's better quality, but looks better than the theater because the theater has a dim bulb or whatever, and you have annoying audience members, to where home video is competing with the theaters. It doesn't have the communal aspect, but in other ways competes with it. And therefore, people only go to the theater when it's like a surefire bet, big franchise that they're excited for. That just is the way it is. And Netflix and all these streaming services are providing a place for more storytellers to get to tell stories, and more people will watch them because it's at home. And I think that's all a good thing. But it's interesting the way, you know, you look at it when you have Marriage Story and The Irishman both getting all kinds of Oscar love. You know, they're actually attracting top tier talent to make movies that people are paying attention to.
And this year with David Fincher's Mank, I mean, it's not like it was 2019, because we all thought 2018 was the big year with Roma. And then 2019 managed to top that.
Yep.
Not in terms of wins, but in terms of nominations. Mm-hmm. And now we have David Fincher. And I know of multiple movies coming out this year that people are going to be talking about come Oscar season. So I think this trend will continue. It's just, can Netflix afford to continue?
So we actually just lost Austin for about 10 minutes there. His phone died. He disappeared middle of the thought. It sounded like it was going to be life-changing and resolve all sorts of world troubles, and then he just disappeared. We finally got him back. Austin, what were you saying there?
Yeah, man, I'm so sorry about that. I was in the middle of talking about the future releases of Netflix, but just kind of coming out this year and how Mank is basically not changing the game, but we're going forward into the future of what Netflix could be and kind of keeping on the track that we had with Marriage Story and The Irishman. And I believe I said how 2018 was one thing, right? We thought it was going to be the year for Netflix with Roma. And then we got 2019 with Marriage Story and The Irishman. And now we have a David Fincher-directed movie, and obviously transitioning over from Mindhunter. He's a pretty big fan of Netflix. But we have so many more films to look out for. And even in the world of series, not to stray too far away from movies, there are so many series coming out on Netflix this year that people are saying could be Emmy worthy. So Netflix is trending, trajecting in a good direction, but it really does all come down to the execution and how they go about releasing these bigger movies and limiting themselves from picking up every idea and every, I believe it was a recent episode of Rick and Morty where they hit on the fact that Netflix says yes to everything. Every idea. It was Morty went to a business meeting and he started pitching something. He's just like, yeah, we'll just do a TV show, a movie about this thing. And they're like, perfect. Sounds great. We're going to pick it up, an 8-episode series. So it does kind of feel like that. But if they establish themselves as, you know, a studio to be reckoned with the Oscars and the Emmys, which they have been doing over the last year, then I think they're going to be a force to be reckoned with. It just, once again, it's can they keep themselves above ground, which is what they've been dealing with as of late.
I'll use that as a little bit of a transition. So one of the problems I have with Netflix is they just crank out so much stuff that you can just, even things you're interested in that have people that you want to watch, there's so many things that you can't even keep up with it. Like a Paul Rudd TV show debuted, and just because I couldn't watch it that week, it just disappeared from my mind pretty quickly. Yeah. How do you stay ahead on what's coming out? Or what tips, tactics do you have to like know what projects they're working on? Because that's certainly one of their weaknesses. They're not good at self-promotion.
It's difficult. A lot of it comes down to you get on Google and you search, but there are plenty of great of articles that come out on a monthly basis that have great lists. There's one in particular. It's, I believe, BGR is the website, and the guy's name is Zach, and he's been doing this article that I kind of, and things tend to change and they bring in new movies and new TV shows, but he's been writing this article every month for the last, I believe, year on what is coming out via Netflix, whether it's a show or a movie, but not just the big shows. He's talking the anime films, the little, the foreign movies that, you know, I saw a movie, I believe it's called 37 Seconds, and it's one of my favorite movies of the year so far, and it's a Netflix original film. I would have never seen that without his article.
Yeah.
So if you search for these articles, and I would, if you guys are looking for it, I would honestly just monthly Netflix release schedule, because Netflix doesn't actually inform, unless it's a big time film, doesn't inform those looking for it until about a month, month and a half out, whether it's a foreign film or some of these oddball TV shows that actually end up being pretty good. So that's usually how I go about it. And then Twitter. Twitter is a great place. Keep the notifications on for the I believe it's the NX Twitter page, the Netflix like Film Fun Twitter page, like all of these Netflix-centric Twitter pages. And every now and then you'll get, and it's a lot of tweets, so it might spam your phone, but every now and then you'll get one. It's like, hey, Netflix just announced this for a month out, this release date for this original film. And that's when I get in my calendar and I write these things down. But even I, the crazy guy who watches everything on Netflix, even I miss things, right? There was a show 2 weeks ago, came out, left. I mean, and those who did reviews on it, it sounded really interesting. But I was 2 days late. I was 3 days late. And I'm like, oh, I mean, but now I have this other show that I have to watch. So I don't have time to catch up on this show. But all of the reviews were glowing. So it's like, I missed that. And a lot of that, and I'm sorry if I'm going on a tirade here, but a lot of that comes down to the binge model on Netflix. Is this something that is working for them? Obviously, it's working somewhat or they wouldn't keep doing it. But here's what I loved about a show like The Mandalorian, is The Mandalorian came out, it was the topic of discussion for 2 months. Yep. No one stopped talking about it. Why? Because we got a new episode every week or every 2 weeks. And we continued to get that throughout those 2 months, and no one stopped talking about it. Even a show like Stranger Things, it comes out, it's being talked about like crazy for 2 or 3 weeks, and then it's donezo. It's donezo. Why is that? Well, the binge model, it's great for what I do because I like to binge and review, but for Netflix, keeping these in the minds of the viewers for longer than maybe a month's period of time, maybe that's something they need to, and they've said they're going to switch it up, change things before, but maybe that's something they need to actually look at, because Disney Plus, what they did with The Mandalorian, I thought that was the perfect method, to be honest.
And as someone that's The Mandalorian, it was the first TV show I ever like was excited about at the same time my son was excited for. We were both like, oh, I can't wait for that to come out. And so then that became part of our weekly tradition. Friday after school, I pick him up and then we just come home and immediately watch the next episode. And if it was a binge model, that would have been like one Friday. Like, all right, we're just going to stay up late watching the whole show. And the binge model was awesome for a little while, but now it's a little bit like the novelty of watching a whole season over a couple of days. I don't know. I'm not feeling it quite as much. Griffin, how do you feel about the binge model?
I like it, actually. Like, I know, like, Disney Plus right now, they're doing Clone Wars every Friday, kind of like, you know, replacing that with The Mandalorian. And those are, like, it's 20-minute episodes once a week, and I'm like, I really want to just watch the rest of this season.
Yeah.
It's like, so, like, for me, it depends on the show. If it's big budget, like, you know, Game of Thrones, Westworld type stuff, I like that week-long break, but you're also giving me, like, a lot of content on, like, one given day. But, like, something with, like, The Mandalorian or like, Clone Wars, stuff where, like, the episodes are shorter, I almost prefer a binge model. So, like, it really, for me, does depend on the type of content that they're producing.
So, let's close out. Sorry.
No, you're fine. Just to pitch in, well, there was a show that came out this last weekend on Amazon Prime called Hunters, right? Yeah. Now, Hunters, the pilot was an hour and a half. That to me, and the rest of the other episodes were like an hour and 15 minutes long. So that to me is the perfect show to do on a weekly basis. And it's also a very difficult show to binge, something like On My Block. I don't know if you guys have seen that on Netflix. Those episodes are 30 minutes, and I think that is the perfect show to binge. So yeah. I'm with you, Griffin. I think it all comes down to what kind of show do you have? Is it a comedy? Is it a drama? Is it something that you need some time to let the episode soak in? Yeah. And then, is it something that is going to stick in them? Or is it something that feels more episodic? Like some of these shows, every episode's a cliffhanger. And then other shows, some episodes just kind of lead right into the next. So if Netflix was up for maybe, you know, for this show, we're going to do this show, we're going to do that. I feel like even that would be a better method. But you guys know, I like to binge.
Yeah, I mean,
that's kind of what I do. So
I agree. It's definitely a case-by-case basis.
Absolutely.
So closing on our last little segment on here, sending this one over to you, Austin. Deep cuts. Yep. What Netflix movies from the year 2020 do I need to check out?
Oh, well, so far, and there aren't many, because so far, the ones that I've watched, the most recent one that I watched was called The Last Thing He Wanted. Oh. And it was The Last Thing That I Wanted. Yeah, don't watch that. But there are a few. So I did see a movie called 37 Seconds, and I mentioned this before. Yep. It was a wonderful, wonderful film. You actually had a disabled lead playing a disabled character, and the soft-spoken nature of that character kind of broke my heart the entire time because it was such a raw and deep film. I absolutely loved it. And then, like I mentioned before, Mank is a movie coming out from David Fincher that I think everyone is looking forward to. You have one called Hillbilly Elegy. This is directed by Ron Howard. And Ron Howard isn't my favorite filmmaker, But you have actresses like Amy Adams and Glenn Close, and there's a lot of potential Oscar talk and hype behind that. And the one that for some reason I'm like super excited for, it's called Da Five Bloods, and it's directed by Spike Lee. It's the latest Spike Lee joint. And it stars Chadwick Boseman and Paul Walter Hauser, who is one of my favorite kind of up and coming. We're about to hit it big actors. And it is, it's about, it's searching for the remains of their fallen squad leader and the promise of buried treasure. It's all about this group, returning to Vietnam on this mission. And the cast looks incredible. And then, you know, obviously you've got movies like the To All the Boys I've Loved Before, P.S. I Love You. And not everyone was a fan of that movie, but every now and then you get a rom-com that kind of works. Mm-hmm. Most of the rom-coms, most of the comedic-based films, they don't work very well on Netflix. But there are a few coming out this year. Just the list that I'm looking at, man, there are 4 to 5 opportunities for Netflix to actually make a splash. And they made a splash this last year. But The Irishman went home with 0 awards. Marriage Story didn't do as well as I think they wanted it to. There's a possibility for Netflix to do even better in the winning. Like, we're going to win some Oscars this year instead of just get nominated, and for people to take that platform even more seriously. And you're seeing even more directors kind of join the platform. So far in 2020, it's not been great. There are 7 movies on my letterbox that I do not like on Netflix, but there's a good possibility that it picks up and 2020 could be... Who knows? It could be even better than 2019 was, but that was a great year for Netflix. I mean, from Klaus to Dolomite to Marriage Story to Irishman, a lot of underrated gems last year. So a great 2-year span possibly for Netflix in the movie category.
Yeah. So this year, I guess they've got Army of the Dead from one Zack Snyder.
Yes.
That's, of course, Zack Snyder doing a zombie movie with Dave Bautista. You're speaking the language of my heart. And so hopefully that one will get some Oscar buzz, probably acting categories for Dave Bautista. Do you have anything on your, when in regards to Netflix original films or TV shows, I guess, if you want to throw in there too, on for you, Griffin, that you're excited about, that you've heard about?
No, not that I really can think. Not that I can think of. I mean, like, yeah, David Fincher's new movie. I just want to see a new David Fincher movie. For God's sake, it's been
in the span of our channels. He hasn't put a movie out.
I know.
In the whole time we had our channels, he hasn't put a movie out. It's crazy.
It's man. It just it drives me crazy. But yeah, no, that one obviously Zack Snyder's film. You know, Netflix also will purchase like other festival films, I'm sure. So we'll see. But those are the only ones I can think of at the moment.
All righty. Thank you guys so much for joining me. We had a little bit of excitement there with the phone dying. And I think this is our longest podcast we've done yet. There's a lot to talk about. Lots of little things and had a nice little discussion. Griffin, where can we find you on the internet?
Yeah, you guys can head on over to the FilmSpeak channel where I just put out my review of The Invisible Man. So if you want to hear my full thoughts on that, where I gush over the film, you can head over there. And then you can also give me a follow on Twitter at Griff Schiller.
And Austin Burke, where can we find you on the internet?
YouTube.com/AustinBurke, talking Netflix and movies and news and all of those wonderful things. Twitter and Instagram at the Burke.
You guys don't know why we're laughing, which you probably don't.
Right.
I guess his phone died again right as he was telling us where to find him. So down below in the description, you'll have all the information on where to find everybody. Austin is also super active over on Letterboxd. So if you want to dive in deep into his stuff, you can find him over there. Wherever you're listening to this podcast or if you're watching it, be sure to leave that review and that rating. Early on, these phrases where I'm trying to get that momentum, I would love your support in helping making that happen by just leaving some kind words over there. And as always, keep talking movies too much.